Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to Untangled from All Sides in WOSU Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Across the country and here in Central Ohio, work is changing fast, creating new opportunities and real questions for workers, families, and employers navigating a complex moment. This is Untangled, a show where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, explain it in a way that's easier to understand. This season, we are tackling work. For decades, research has shown that having a bachelor's degree will lead to better employment prospects. But in an age where artificial intelligence is creating instability in white-collar workplaces, there is a shift in that go-to-college-to-get-a-job mentality. And then there's that trade school versus college debate, which also dovetails into a conversation about underemployment among college graduates. To help us figure out whether all that talk of a four-year degree is worth it, we have Jeff Stroll, research professor and director of Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce. Welcome to the show, Professor Stroll.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with this recent study that your center did. You were trying to answer the question, how many college graduates are underemployed, meaning workers possess more education or skills than the job requires. But you actually found out that this is really hard to measure, right? Isn't that what you discovered?
Yeah, absolutely. If you take a look at the research, the data actually goes from, or the results go from 52% of recent college graduates not using their skills on their job to around 26 when you enter the labor market. And it's a wide range. And so a lot of the problems that we have is really identifying both the skills that somebody has as well as the tasks that are needed on the job. And so bringing those two pieces of information together is a difficult measurement. And what we're calling for really in our work is that a federal agency needs to pull together all these different measures and get down to really trying to understand this better, because we're sending a bad message to people that it isn't worth it. Because basically, if you believe 52%, you might as well just shut down the post-secondary education system, because we have too many people and they're not going to be using their skills. And that just doesn't pass a smell test.
Yeah. But and it also matters the age of the person. Like, you know, someone who is underemployed at age 22 means something completely different than someone underemployed at age 44, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And so in all of the work that you look at on underemployment, they all have a declining rate of underemployment. And this really reflects how we do job matching in the U.S. labor market. What we do, we educate people and then we basically dump them into the labor market and say, go swim. And so that go swim part makes it so in the U.S. economy today, people have about 12.5 jobs across the life cycle. In Europe, it's between 2 and 4. And so that ability to latch on to a career or a job is much more difficult in the U.S., and it usually takes, I'm guessing, 7 to 10 years of the first part of the career to fully land on something that you would call your career. I've had too many jobs to count myself.
All right, I got it. But and then there's also that stereotype of the barista with a diploma living in their parents' basement, right? So if you ask a four-year college, they're going to tell you, you know, numbers that make it seem like that never happens, right? There's no baristas with bachelor's degrees. But then you found out that some economists are probably just overestimating how often it happens. So that's where you get that 50% plus number from. So do you think, just from your research, I know you said that we need to like figure this out better, but are there a lot of underemployed college graduates out there?
I think it's really when you look, as you pointed out, on age and also when you look in the business cycle. So right now in the U.S. economy, we're facing lots of economic headwinds. We're facing lots of uncertainty in employers from tariffs. And let's even forget about AI right now in this conversation. We just have enough that the labor market has frozen. So we went through something like 10 million separations and hires a month in the U.S. economy to about 3. And so what this really reflects is employers are uncertain about hiring in. People don't want to change jobs to the next job, so it's frozen up that labor market. So it's made for potentially more people underemployed because you have to take what's in front of you, i.e. the barista job. You have to put dinner on the table. So we have to face that some people are going to be underemployed, and but that can be for transitory reasons, that can be for personal reasons, and it can be, frankly, that they just can't latch on to the right job. So we're guesstimating that it probably drops to around maybe 17 to 20% over time when people latch on.
All right. So 20%, that's a little more palatable than 50%. I think we can, you know, at least four-year colleges will like that number, right?
Yes.
Yes.
That's right.
This is Untangled from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this show is a part of the WOSU Public Media Project Inside Reshaping Work. We're talking about the use of college degrees in the working world with Jeff Stroll, research professor and director of the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. I wanted to pivot to those people in their early 20s for a minute. This is the time of year when college graduates are all being asked what's next, and they're expected to have this great answer of how they're using their brand new degree. What have you found out about the job market that they're entering right now?
Oof, that's a hard one because the data is a little slow to come at us. So we have a lot of noise and storytelling. So right now, everybody wants us, or at least the tech bros want us to believe that AI is causing a tsunami and destroying all jobs. Or in fact, most of the impact that we can see from AI is really through investment sectorial shifts. Meta just made a big layoff, and that's what they said, that we need to shift money. So it's not really clear how it is going to impact on the workplace. So that's one factor, is the fear factor that college graduates face. Secondly, is all the economic uncertainty. We went through reduction in force in the federal government. All these research grants got cut. And so all of a sudden you have excess skilled labor in the labor market. And then you've got 3 million or so graduates coming into the labor market in May. It's going to clog up. And so we did a report called The Summer Surge, and we estimate that it takes about 9 months for the economy to absorb each of these cohorts of graduates. So it makes it difficult for those students. And add on top of that all the disruptions that's happened to professional jobs over the last year and a half. It even adds another layer. I think the RIF folks and stuff are slowly settling in, so I hope next cohort it'll be good. But It's a tough lot out there. And, you know, I think we have to balance stories of somebody with 100 resumes with the fact that, you know, unemployment among college graduates, around 5-6, something like that. So it's above the overall, but that's normal for youth.
Yeah. And maybe give themselves a little grace of that 9 months to find what they're looking for.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of talk out there about going to trade school instead of a four-year degree. In producing this series that we're calling Reshaping Work, I've heard a lot of talk from a lot of people about the need for electricians, skilled construction workers. Everyone keeps talking about how we need more welders. Our country is really in need of more welders right now. Do you come from the mindset that the push for that four-year degree going to college needs to change at all? Is there room for pursuing both college and trade school in this world?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you asked it in that way, because normally people ask this of one extreme or the other. Right? And I think that you hit it right on the nose, which is we need to have a balanced approach to this. I was dealing with some folks in Florida who were asking this question, trying to figure out skilled trades versus other. And somebody was suggesting that high school graduates could just flood into skilled trades. I looked at the data. 4% of high school graduates are in skilled trades. They earn more when they do it. But it's a very limited scope. So we have to think about how skilled trades grow. Skilled trades are really directly tied with population growth. We're having flattening population growth. Mm-hmm. You think about it, how many houses do you need for new people? Well, if you have a slowdown in construction, well, then you have a slowdown in the need for electricians. Our data projecting to 2032 suggests that what we call this middle skills area is going to stay fairly flat. There's lots of opportunity there, but we have to weigh it out, like how many jobs are we talking about for a high school class or for a generation to go into? So it does offer opportunity. I was a carpenter and plumber for about 10 or 12 years before I dropped out of college and went back. And great opportunity, but it's difficult work. And if you look at linemen, they age out about age 40 because their bodies go to heck. And if you don't become a supervisor, that's it. So we have to be thinking about the life cycle. And also the last thing on skilled trades is people often look to fully matured journeymen or masters in the trade and look at their earnings and say, all these apprenticeship programs are going to lead automatically to that wage, where actually the time it takes from starting and graduating an apprenticeship program to hitting peak wage is a lot longer than people acknowledge. So let's just be honest on both things, honest on college to your initial point, but also honest on the scope of opportunity in the skilled trades.
All right, you're not going to come out of high school as a master carpenter making as much as your boss. Yeah. Okay. So I had someone say to me recently in doing this series that what we need to do is kind of lessen this intense push on the four-year degree, though. But what needs to change is we need to train parents differently. So when your kid comes home, so when your kid comes home from school and says, hey, I want to be a welder, so that the parent says, that's great news, let's find you a program, rather than the immediate reaction being, no, you're not, you're going to college. What are your thoughts on that mindset shift?
I think that's an interesting perspective. We should actually, you know, encourage youth today, and I've got a 20-year-old trying to figure out what their passions are, to allow them to follow it while being honest about the amount of economic opportunity that exists in any of these given areas. Because with only a high school degree, if you don't latch on to working in field, you're not going to make a lot of money. So I think it can be a good thing. But what we have is a big problem in the United States, is that we've underinvested in counseling. So we've got all this great information, but what do we turn to? Person closest to us. And while many of our parents and friends might have good information, it's not complete information. And so it's only one perspective, and we need to do a better job to help students and those parents understand the implications of what they're suggesting. So a welder. So if everybody becomes a welder, guess what? You're going to have a heck of a lot of unemployed people being welders. So that scope, scale, and opportunity, what the work is like, people need the better information, and we don't provide it. And so if we're just going to turn to a parent, myself could fail, you could be wrong, anybody could be wrong. So we need more investment in our counseling apparatus.
Your center, the Center for on Education in the Workforce, released a study last fall related to skills shortages. So it said the U.S. economy needs 5.25 million additional workers with education and training beyond high school through 2032. What type of skills are you talking there when you say there's a skills shortage?
In that report, honestly, we're just using degree as a marker for skill. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about gradated skills that have really become part of the conversation. So it's not really a named skill, but it is the differentiation between probably more specific and then a balance of general and specific skills that you tend to get with a four-year degree. So a four-year degree is often split between specific education, being an accountant, plus your gen ed requirements. And that brings together general and specific skills, which open up cognitive flexibility in the workforce. And the rate of stuff changing out there in the labor market, we can't get people to go back to school. So they have to be empowered with this combination of skill sets and educational delivery so that they themselves can be flexible in the face of change.
I talked with the leader of our area chamber of commerce, and he says that we need to all be more adaptable and become lifelong learners. We need to all be willing in our jobs to learn to change, learn more, you know, grow with the job, change with the job. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at productivity gains, wages, that education explains a lot of your entry wage, but the rest of your career is all about the experience. So people already learn on the job. People already have that type of resilience in the labor market. And you can see it by the gains through experience. Now, we need to focus on it more. We need to really empower the worker to take on that task and have the confidence that you can face change. And people get that with age as they move. So, but absolutely, if we don't have a workforce that can respond to change, we don't have an education and training system big enough to send everybody back to a training program every time they need to make an adjustment. So the American model is extremely unique in this regard because of that flexibility of our labor force. And we sure need to focus, keep focusing on it.
And back to that study about the skills shortage. I mean, some of the jobs that you cite in that study are a need for attorneys, doctors, engineers, nurses, teachers. You know, it really runs the gamut. But then you also said that this skills shortage presents an opportunity for millions of workers, particularly those from low-income households and marginalized racial and ethnic groups, to gain better access to economic opportunities. Can you explain a little more? I mean, are we needing to have to tell low-income households and these more marginalized groups, like, you know, like, go to school for this? This is what's needed.
Well, what I've been saying this for a little bit now, that equity is no longer just a nice thing. It's actually an economic imperative, and especially if continued momentum on deportations happen, we're exiting a lot of skill from the labor market, mm-hmm. both from the low-skilled and the high-skilled portion of the labor market. So that means we have to be able to support and grow our own internal talent, and so many people have been left on the sidelines. Every year, out of a high school graduation class, between 500 and 600,000 students from the top half of the high school class do not get a degree, any kind of degree. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a huge waste of talent. We're not talking about students who failed out of high school and, you know, reaching really deep. Sometime I think we're going to have to, but we're talking, we have a loss rate of talent in the economy, and we have business groups saying we don't have enough talent. Well, let's go and help everybody uplift.
Mm. Are you saying because they feel like they can't afford college, so they end up just not doing it? Is that what you mean?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of different factors. So, for instance, if your parents only have a high school degree, you have about a 27% chance of getting a BA. If your parents have a professional degree, you have about an 83% chance of getting a BA. So there is social capital and expectational formation in the home that is accelerated if your parents hire college graduates. And it's a little more difficult if your parents aren't, for the first time, college going students, not only because of the financial side, but the whole culture of college goingness, it isn't supported. Just back to retraining parents about being a welder. Mm. Well, there's a whole number of parents who have never had the opportunity to think about going to college, let alone go to college. So when the children go to those parents are less equipped to help them figure out, is college the right thing? How do you afford it? Or where do you go? I mean, there's all these questions out there. And back to my thing about the counseling system. We've underinvested. Right now, counselors should be 250 to 1. They're like 750 to 1. I mean, you just line them up your door, you give them Naviance, and you're done. I mean, they can't really be as helpful as they should be, and not their fault, but I think it's a resource allocation problem.
Yeah. And so we need guidance counselors, more guidance counselors, and guidance counselors for parents too. All right.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's yeah. Right. That's a good line. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about using a college degree in the workplace with Jeff Stroll, research professor and director of the Georgetown University Center on Education in the Workforce. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we're going to hear from the Franklin County Trades Academy, which recently had a crop of graduates who are ready for full-time jobs in plumbing, construction, HVAC, and more. That's when Untangled Reshaping Work continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to Untangled from All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Untangled is a show where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, explain it in a way that's easier to understand. This season, we are tackling work. Deciding what to do after high school used to feel like a one-way street leading straight to a four-year university. Today, however, the rising cost of tuition and a shifting labor market have reopened the debate between traditional college paths and specialized trade schools. While a bachelor's degree offers a broad academic foundation and access to diverse career fields, trade schools provide a streamlined, cost-effective route to high-demand technical careers. Ultimately, neither path is superior. Instead, the right choice depends on an individual's financial goals, learning style, and long-term career aspirations in an evolving economy. Joining us now to talk about the way we get more people involved in high-demand careers in the trades, we have Stephanie Hightower, the president and CEO of the Columbus Urban League. The Columbus Urban League is the administrator of the Franklin County Trades Academy. Welcome back to the show, Stephanie.
Thank you for having us.
So the Franklin County Trades Academy, a seven-week, full-time, no-cost training program for those who are serious about a career in the skilled trades. And I know you just graduated your fourth cohort of students. Tell me, how is the program going?
The program is, and it's an excellent way for those folks who need to upskill themselves and who are looking to go into the trades, for them to come in a meaningful way. Right now, we have about 1,500 people on the wait list.
Whoa, that's a long wait list. That's okay.
It's a long wait list. And so that really just explains or says, Amy, how well the program is. And this is without any type of marketing. This is by word of mouth and people who have come into our Career Connect Hub information sessions.
So I was impressed with the diverse jobs represented in your most recent graduating class. There was construction and plumbing, masonry, electricians. Do you fit students with jobs, or do the jobs come first and they pick the students?
So it's really a combination of both. One of the things that with this new program that we reinvigorated earlier this year was we wanted to make sure that people were going to go to work as soon as they finished. And so what we've been trying to do is match up. We know with all the construction that's going on in Columbus, Franklin County, Licking County, they kind of tell you what the skills are that are needed at certain times and certain projects. And so what we try to do is we try to slide, or we try to inform those people that these are the jobs that are going to be readily available. Now, if you want to be in masonry, but there may not be jobs for 6 months, then you're going to know that up front. But if they're saying they need skilled laborers, or they need welders right now, or they need electricians, then that's where we try to guide people. And what we do is we have what we call as a Career Connect Hub Day, where we do a 4E's presentation, and the unions and the workers or welders or electricians, the skilled laborers come in and they explain to those prospects, here's the day in the life of these jobs. And so then that does is it gives the people the opportunity to make a fair assessment as to whether or not this is the skilled trade that they want to go into.
So when they apply, those 1,500 people who are on the wait list, when they apply to be a part of the Franklin County Trades Academy, do they write on their application what they want to be, or they just know they want to be in the program, they want to be in a skilled trade, and then you help them find which one?
That's exactly what the process is. They mm-hmm. sign up, and then we say you have to go through this explain, explore process mm-hmm. so that then you can determine what it is that you want to do and that you know you want to do prior to you just getting into the apprenticeship program and then finding out later on, I don't really like this, or this is not of interest to me.
Now, your most recent graduating class, I mean, you have great numbers. I mean, people stick with this program. I think, you know, your cohort, cohort four had 26 people in it, and only one had to drop out for personal reasons. So you graduated 25 of the 26, which is a great percentage. Are you trying to, so I'm noticing from cohort one that had 20 people in it to cohort four that had 26. Are you trying to make it a little bit bigger each time?
No, because, you know, with that yeah. large size, you need to keep it small so that people can really get that sort of intimate details and really that one-on-one, hands-on mm-hmm. type of curriculum and skill building. So while we would love to have, you know, 50 people in a class, most of the instructors say we can only, about 25, no more, definitely no more than 30 should be in these classes.
Okay. And so, but the fact that you have everyone complete it, I mean, are you, when you pick the people who are in here, you're making sure they're serious, they want this, they're looking for this career.
Absolutely. So that's why we take the time to front load the information with individuals. And then you have to also realize that there is a $300 a week stipend attached to this. Mm-hmm. And so they understand, because we want them to be in school. This is their job. And so they understand if you miss a day or miss 2 days, you won't be paid that $300 as mm-hmm. well. So we make sure that we're putting in place those compliant kinds of things so that people understand if you're really serious and if you are using this as an additional income stream while you're going through this program, because you probably still have another job, mm-hmm. then if you're serious and you need this and you need these dollars, you got to come to class.
Mm. So we spent the first part of the show talking about whether a four-year college degree is worth it anymore. And I think the bottom line was, yes, it is worth it, just not for everyone. Tell me about the people who want to go into the people who apply, who want to be a part of the Franklin County Trades Academy. Who are they? What kind of foot in the door are they trying to get?
So, you know, our key demographics right now are justice-involved people. So we do go after and recruit those individuals. People who are underrepresented in the communities who may not know what these different job opportunities are. And believe it or not, and one of the things that Commissioner Crawley wanted us to be very mindful of when they reallocated these funds to us is she wanted to have a significant amount of women that go through this program too. So we're really proud that we have about 30% of all of the folks who have come through are women. I think this last class, I think half of them might have been women, almost half of the 25, I think 11 out of the 12. So it really goes to show that women have an interest, but again, women didn't know that they had these opportunities available to them. And now that they see other women completing this program, we're starting to get some traction.
This is Untangled from All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This show is a part of the WOSU Public Media Project, Inside Reshaping Work. We're talking about increasing access to the skilled trades with the president and CEO of the Columbus Urban League, Stephanie Hightower. The Urban League is the administrator for the Franklin County Trades Academy. Now, it's well documented that there's underrepresentation of Black workers in the skilled trades. This is driven by a legacy of systemic exclusion from labor unions and apprenticeship programs. But do you feel like the tides are turning here with this program that you have, or are you turning the tides yourself?
No, I think this program is turning the tides. And when this program was initially conceived, it was about how do we get more people of color, more underrepresented people, more women in the trades. But one of the things that we know now, again, when you look at all of the construction that's going on in Franklin and Licking County, and when you also look at from a generational standpoint, a lot of folks that were in the unions, one of the things that we're hearing now is that their children or their children's children no longer have an interest in going into the unions. And so we're going to be hopefully working a lot closer with the trades and building futures so that we can make sure that we're bringing those individuals from underrepresented groups and women to the table, as well as those who have been justice involved, be able to recruit them and get them into the trades program so they can go through a full apprenticeship program.
I found a statistic that said that while comprising 12% of the overall U.S. workforce, Black workers make up only 7% of the construction industry. For your program, 88% of your graduates are Black. So what does it tell you about this? Are they feeling welcome, or is it just, you know, once you see it, you can do the job? Like, what are you finding there?
You know, so when we do the Career Connect Hub, what we do is we have people who look like those people come to the room, and then they're explaining to them from a cultural standpoint, this is what the day in the life of these jobs are. So we're working with the women in trades groups, and so they come in and they talk to the women prospects. We have people of color, whether they're Hispanic or Black, they come in, and these are skilled laborers. These are electricians that come in and talk to folks who look like them. Mm-hmm. And so I think what that does is it gives people a sense of inspiration and the ability to know that they can actually do this because there are people that look like them out there doing these jobs.
So your overall placement rate is about 83%, but it says on the paper that I got from your organization that the union apprenticeship rate is 8%. So how do we get that union rate higher?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, we're going to be working very closely with the unions. We're in the process of trying to figure out what our contractual agreement will look like. So we're really excited that we're going to be looking and working with them for this next cohort to come through so that we can increase that rate. One of the things that's happening now is a lot of our people are going into the private sector. Mm. Now, they are being placed, but they're in non-union jobs, which means their apprenticeship journey may be a little bit different than if they went through the unions. So that's what the difference is right now. And we want to get more folks engaged with the unions, engage in their apprenticeship programs, because we know, especially a journeyman or journeywoman program, they will then earn a lot more money down the road. Now, it takes a minute. It's not an overnight success, right? Mm-hmm. You have to stay very engaged, but we are going to be working very closely with the unions in the near future to get them, more of them, in the union program.
So they're all getting jobs. It just might not be a union job.
Correct.
So is the union job better? I don't even know if I want to use the word better. Is there more of a career track there?
You know, I think it's a matter of, you know, which projects. As you know, there mm-hmm. are public projects, there are private projects. Mm-hmm. Union wages are generally a lot higher than mm-hmm. some of the private. And so...
Or maybe benefits are different.
Private, you don't have to pay dues. Union, you have to pay dues. Mm-hmm. But being in the union and being in that apprenticeship programs is probably going to move you up a lot quicker mm-hmm. to go on track than if you're working in the private sector.
So tell me about you. So you've done four cohorts. Tell me about cohort five. Are we planning on five?
Absolutely, we're mm-hmm. planning on five. So we have also funding from the National Urban League through the Department of Labor mm-hmm. Program that basically the National Urban League went to the Department of Labor about 2.5 years ago based upon the program that we had here in Columbus that we incubated for 5 years and basically went and sold that to the Department of Labor. Mm-hmm. And so they have been funding in five states basically apprenticeship programs, and we're one of those.
Okay, so I know you have this wait list, so I guess you don't even want more people to apply. I was like, when does cohort five start?
Yeah. Well, we're still trying to figure that out right now. We're hoping by August we can get that next group of people lined up and ready to go. Well, we know the people are ready to go. Mm-hmm. We just need to re-interview of those 1,500. And again, what's really important here is if we get this new during this next iteration of this, mm-hmm. there's going to be two cohorts going on simultaneously. There's mm-hmm. going to be a cohort that's going to be going on during the day, and then there's going to be a cohort that's going to be a little bit longer because it's going to be in the evenings, and it's only going to be 3 hours a night as opposed to staying 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. But we're going to mm-hmm. start with, we're going to have two cohorts that are going to be running. So we're really excited about mm-hmm. this opportunity to get at least 50 people in the queue and get them out in the workforce.
Oh, that's great. And there's a little more flexibility there, so they can do the evenings if they have childcare issues or another job.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. They just have a little bit longer period.
Yeah. So is there money there for this to continue forever? There's never forever money, I guess. Yeah.
Well, you know what, with all of the, you know, uncertainty that's going on, you know, in the climate and workforce climate right now in Washington, D.C., you know, my hope is that because even when Husted was still here at the state, they were looking at apprenticeship programs mm-hmm. And they see the value of them across the state. And you can see there are a lot of apprenticeship programs when you start doing and calculating across the state. I think that our Franklin County commissioners, which we're so grateful of, they see the value of what this actually does, how it changed lives, how it really impacts the economy, how we get more people paying taxes, right? How we have more people that are actually out here working. So I'm hopeful that the current leadership at the county will continue as long as they possibly can to make sure that this program continues.
And just you as being in charge of the Columbus Urban League, being the administrator of this program, how proud are you of this? You must be so proud of this.
Oh, gosh. This is one that we've been fighting for. Mm-hmm. You know, we had it for 5 years. It then, you know, transitioned to another entity. That entity didn't progress as well as everyone thought. And so this was one that I was willing to go back to the county commissioners, really show the impact and the value with the data, to be able to have data to show. And while it was a hard, you know, lift, they understood, because we had data to be able to back up this program works. And when you see all the construction, everything that's going on in Franklin County, and you see the need, it really makes sense. And everyone can see the return on the investment.
We've been talking about the Franklin County Trades Academy, which is being administered by the Columbus Urban League. And we've been talking with President and CEO of the Urban League, Stephanie Hightower. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Miss Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk about where AI fits into all of this. AI in college, white collar work, and in the trades. That's when Untangled Reshaping Work continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides, and this is Untangled. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Untangled is a show where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you, explain it in a way that's easier to understand. And this season, we are tackling work. The rise of artificial intelligence has added a complex layer to the age-old debate between college and trade school. With a four-year degree focusing on critical thinking and trade schools emphasizing essential manual expertise, the rapid advancement of AI now threatens to automate roles in both sectors. We're going to talk about the rise of artificial intelligence in the workplace with Kevin Fox. He is the founder of Foxworks Group. He helps organizations navigate the rise of AI inside everyday business operations. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to start with the question everyone's always asking. Is AI going to take my job? Maybe not my job, but sure. Yeah. My job, anyone's job. Yeah.
I think it's the wrong question.
Okay.
Really.
Yeah. Ask a different way.
I think... Because it's so based in fear, and I get it. The landscape's changing so quickly. But we've been here before, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if we think back just a little bit, you know, there was a job called calculator, right?
So
right?
True.
Now
so
every
true.
Day we pull out a calculator, yeah. right? And we'll use yeah. it. Well, there was a job. You know, these were, you know, NASA used calculators to project.
Human calculators.
Yeah, human
yeah.
calculators, right? Mm-hmm. And so that tool evolved, kind of took the human name, and now we use it in everyday practice. Well, we're in a similar space now, right, to where there's a lot of hype around AI and a lot of fear-mongering, and I think a lot of that's coming from the folks who have something to gain from that, right? A lot of that's coming from the large platforms, the OpenAIs, the Anthropics, because they need to generate revenue, right? They're burning through cash, so they need CapEx coming in, and so they kind of build these fears. But what the reality is, what we have today, the AI that's built today, is incredibly powerful. And we really need to think about how we can be working alongside of AI. It used to be we go to a trade school or we go to college and we would learn skill sets. We'd learn softwares that were associated with that. The AI is just going to be built on alongside that. AI fluency is just going to be non-negotiable. And what's really exciting is AI still can't do everything, right? It's not going to take everyone's job. AI knows a lot about data. AI doesn't know about people. You know, people. It needs people. And I think that that's one thing that I hope people can and find some excitement and interest in that. Like, I think there's going to be a recurrence, a resurgence in the humanities being studied, right? Because in a world of abundant IQ, EQ is going to be more and more important, right? We need to have, that emotional intelligence, you know? We need to have that ability to, you know, AI can tell us the data. We need EQ to tell us if that data matters to anybody, right? And so that's where I think people should look to AI is like, look, it can help me. It's supercharging me. It's my, you know, I can research faster than ever I could before. I can iterate faster than I ever could before. But at the end of the day, you're using AI, he's using AI, she's using AI. So when you all have access to that intelligence, what are you doing with it, right? What's your filter? So the importance on filtering through that, understanding like what's good from bad, right? Having taste, judgment. So, you know, that arts degree is still going to pay off, right?
All right.
It's good to still learn how to write because, you know, AI can write a lot of things that looks reasonable. But if you truly are a writer, then you can poke and prod and really improve that output, right? So I don't want people to feel like, well, AI is just taking care of everything. No, it's a tool that we can actually use, you know? And I think the important thing is that we just stay curious because it's changing at breakneck speed.
Yeah.
It's really tough to keep up. I mean, I do this full time and I have a hard time sometimes keeping up with where it's going. Yep. But that's going to be the key, is staying curious.
What are you seeing when it comes to businesses embracing AI? Like, when they come to you, are they behind? Are they playing catch up because AI is so advanced?
Yeah, it depends on the size of business. But like, so on the enterprise side, every business has an AI initiative on the table, right?
Yeah.
It's the topic of every board meeting. What are we doing in AI? And so they're building plans and they're looking for help in building that infrastructure. But on the other side, you have small businesses or mid-sized businesses who are like, hey, I need some of that AI everybody's talking about.
Yeah.
Right?
What's this?
And
yeah.
So they really have nowhere to start. And so, you know, that's one thing we do is help give them a baseline and understanding the best way to kind of take that first step in. A lot of times it's as simple as, you know, bolstering, like, don't let phone calls go to voicemail on the weekend or after hours, right? Have an automated voice receptionist handle that. And then send out automations to continue that conversation. It could be, you know, automated booking links that are connected to an AI agent that can have a conversation and answer frequently asked questions. Like, these are like totally like the very beginnings, just dip your toe in the water kind of moments. But what happens is a lot of these businesses don't have that infrastructure, right? Like, well, we have a front desk. Yeah, but like, how many calls are going to voicemail, right? Mm-hmm. And so you start looking at that number. We know that, you know, if a call is not answered, over 80% of people aren't going to leave a voicemail anyway, right? And if they do, you better get back to them within 5 minutes or less, or they're gone, right? If you're in a competitive space. So this totally handles that for them. So instituting small things like that are increasing ROI to, you know, in 30 days, you're seeing a 60% lift, right? Mm. You know, things like that to where, you know, when they're coming from zero, it's really easy. And then what's exciting about AI from the business perspective is when it's built properly, it's an integrated ecosystem, right? So all of your AI systems are talking to each other. They're getting smarter the longer you use them, right?
This is Untangled from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this show is a part of the WOSU Public Media Project, Inside Reshaping Work. We are talking with Kevin Fox, founder of the FoxWorks Group, and he helps organizations navigate the rise of AI inside everyday business operations. There are a lot of AI startups in Central Ohio, and there's a lot of consultants in AI, too. So a part of the reason I wanted to talk to you is your group had presented to the Midwest Roofing Contractors Association and the National Frame Building Association. So if I was to think of some jobs that could not be done by AI, I think roofer would be at the top of that category. So tell me about roofers and framers using AI.
Those are great examples when you talk about someone who's built a very successful business. They may have the operational infrastructure in place to run that business, but they're missing out on those levers that they can pull to really grow and scale, right? And so those are great examples of, you know, from the very beginning of like, hey, I can't answer a phone call if I'm on a roof, right? I'm actually, you have some businesses that are that small, they're actually fulfilling the service and they can't maybe grow their business. So that's where voice receptionist, AI web chats, those things come in handy. Or you could be like, you know what, I have a website, but nobody can find it, right? So leveraging AI tools to really make sure that their business is visible, you know, can have a really outsized effect, you know, because again, they have good reviews, you know, but people aren't finding them in the first place. So there's a lot of ways that you can leverage AI tools and platforms to really just kind of put your business, kind of add an accelerant to it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's true from a business perspective, as you know, as well as individuals, you know, just really looking to supercharge your abilities, right? Rather than seeing it as, you know, a foe, seeing it as really your superpower. So National Frame Building Association is another great example to where you have folks who, it's interesting. I talk a lot of times about, you know, if one day everybody's going to look at AI as just, it's the same as electricity. Right.
Okay. Like, you know, how much longer? How far away
I
is that?
Very, very soon.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
It's going to be a metered utility you bring into your business, and it's just something you know you need to use. Mm-hmm. It's what systems you use and what platforms you bring in and how you connect them. That's going to be your differentiator.
Okay.
Right? But like, so, you know, oftentimes I'll say like most businesses aren't walking around saying I need to get some electricity in my business.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It's just a given. But the electricity itself does nothing. It's what it powers.
Right? Yeah.
So we like to think about AI in that same way. In the National Frame Building Association, we have builders who are, you know, at every stage, some incredibly large organizations and some small builders that are at different stages of that incorporating the AI into their system. And quite frankly, some of them, whether they're using electricity, right?
Yeah.
There's actually a large Mennonite community.
Oh, you mean
community.
Literally.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah. So I don't know if you're going to get the Mennonites to use AI.
Right.
Okay.
Well, you'd be surprised.
Okay.
They may not use it, but someone in their organization can. Right?
Okay. Yeah.
But it really has that line of, you know, it's like electricity. It rings a little differently in that space. But what's interesting is that group is... I've been shocked at how hungry they are to adopt and understand how they can kind of bring in AI and build these efficiencies. So it's been a really fun group to speak to. So I've had the opportunity to speak to their national group a couple of times.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And are they more receptive each year? Because if you spoke more than once, I can imagine.
The first year was like a lot of
sure,
deer in the headlights,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and then, you know, always lots of great questions and after the fact. But this last year it was, you know, full engagement. Everybody's on board. They know I'm not like making all this up. They realize it's a real thing.
Okay. Your website says you are helping organizations rethink how work gets done and what roles humans play in the future. Can you give me an example of that?
Yeah. So the first thing that we always like to do is we run an AI readiness assessment. So we like to look through like what are the roles that are kind of, you know, primed for AI automation, right? And generally, these are the things that you or the people on your team don't want to be doing, right? It's the work of the work. It's the tiresome, burdensome kind of hurdles that get in the way of you achieving what you want to achieve. And so we like to start there. And then we look at the systems and softwares that we would need to connect and add AI intelligence to actually simplify that approach so that you're not, again, replacing that person. You're letting them focus on the thing that they're passionate about. Right, mm-hmm. You're letting them focus on the things that they're really better at and the things that they do better than the AI. So that's the key, is like taking kind of some of the burden and the stress and the out of the workaday work and letting them focus on what they do best.
So I read a piece recently about high school seniors and college freshmen who are out there looking for an AI-proof major, right? And they're having a hard time figuring out what that is because it's changing so fast. Do you know what an AI-proof major would be?
You know, that's a great question.
This article didn't figure it out, but continue.
I think if anyone sat in this chair and they said they had the answer, they'd be full of it. But I don't think it's one major. I think it's a mindset.
Mm.
And I really do believe the mindset is one of curiosity. It's one that, like, this you know, incoming group of students, you know, that are going to be heading out to the workforce, they're going to be facing something no one's ever faced before. Because the landscape is going to be changing more drastically than it's ever changed before, more often, right? So the Industrial Revolution happens. We adapted. We made do. This is going to be the Industrial Revolution over and over again, right?
And faster.
Exactly. Yeah. Much shorter time scale. And then once we think we've figured it out, there's going to be another change, mm-hmm. right? So being adaptable. Being understanding that I didn't, you know, don't think I'm going to go to school, I'm going to major in this, I'm going to learn these things, and then I'm set, right? Mm-hmm. It's be a lifelong learner, be curious, be adaptable, and understand. I think that I really do believe that, you know, intelligence is being democratized. Everyone's mm-hmm. going to have access to lots of intelligence. The IQ is there. Emotional intelligence is going to be huge. It really is.
So the person who was featured in this piece, who was the person who was trying to figure out the AI-proof major, she switched from being a business analytics major to being a marketing major. Mm-hmm. And she said that you can learn to code, but you also need to learn how to communicate and think critically. So is she on the right track?
Exactly. That's what I always say. I think the humanities are making a huge comeback. Mm-hmm. You know, writing, psychology, philosophy, all of that ooey-gooey, touchy-feely human stuff, right? Because that's what the AIs can't do, right? And so I come from a background of marketing and advertising. I've kind of, my career sat at the intersection of creativity, strategy, and technology. And that served me well in this space to be always looking to be solving problems, to be curious, to continue to grow my learning. And I think that's where they want to be. You know, because again, the data can tell you the answer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you need the human can say whether someone's ready to hear that answer, right? And if someone's not ready to hear that answer, the human can craft a story to convince somebody to be ready to hear that answer, right? So storytelling, creativity, strategy, psychology, those things are going to be hugely, hugely important moving forward.
We only have 30 seconds left, but if you want to just leave someone with a note to end on of not being afraid of AI, embracing AI, what would you say?
I think, yeah, certainly it. As we move forward, intelligence is going to be everywhere. Your ability to take in that intelligence and provide a point of view on it and it is going to be the differentiator, right? So get ooey-gooey. Empathy, right?
All right. Major in empathy?
Yeah, major in empathy.
Is that the college proof major? AI-proof major for college?
Oh, ABC, always be curious. Always That's be what curious. I'd leave your folks with.
All right. We have been talking with Kevin Fox, founder of the FoxWorks Group, and he is helping organizations navigate the rise of AI inside everyday business operations. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me.
This is Untangled Reshaping Work from All Sides and WOSU. Be sure to subscribe to the Untangled podcast so you don't miss an episode. Next time, we are going to hear from three experts who were featured at our Inside Reshaping Work WOSU-TV Town Hall. We're going to discuss the future of work, immigration, and AI. Listen next time. This is Untangled and All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.